From GPB News, this is On Second Thought. I'm Adam Ragusea. Diversifying the comic book world.
Young kids picking up the book who have no idea about the Tuskegee Airmen can sit in that same seat and also look back and say, who? But the kids are, you know, very versed and very well aware of the history of the Tuskegee Airmen in the book.
That's Marcus Williams, co-creator of the comic Tuskegee Airs, Flames of Destiny. Ahead this hour, we talk with Williams and his co-author about how their work pays tribute to the real-life Tuskegee Airmen. But first, we continue to talk about Confederate monuments in Georgia. We heard from Georgia State University professor Richard Stafford, who says he has close connections to both the Union and the Confederacy.
I had a great-great-grandfather die on both sides of the war, but I don't see that there's a place for monuments that celebrate an attempt to overthrow the United States or topple the United States government in favor of the Confederacy. And it was illegal what we did here in the South, and it should not be celebrated in statues.
We always want to know what you think, listeners. Call us at 404-500-9457. We're on Twitter at OST Talk, or you can post to Facebook, and we might feature your comments on the show. Well, last month, cast members from TV's A Different World reunited at Home Depot's Atlanta headquarters. They were there to award $365,000 in renovation grant money to 9 historically black colleges and universities. Now, nice though that money may have been, it's probably a drop in the bucket when you think about how expensive historic renovation can be. The Atlanta Journal-Constitution reports that HBCUs have received less philanthropic support than most colleges and universities, particularly for infrastructure and campus renovation projects. The AJC has looked at the role of HBCUs in America and the financial health of those schools. It's a series they've done called HBCUs, A Threatened Heritage. I talked to the reporters of the series, Eric Sturgis and Ernie Suggs, and I began by asking Eric what heritage is being threatened.
Well, there are a number of HBCUs nationally, particularly the smaller ones, that are having a number of serious financial and academic challenges. Through our reporting, we found that many of them, you know, have graduation rates that are hovering around 20%, and when the national average is about 60% when you look at graduation rates. And many of them are having, you know, as I mentioned, significant financial challenges. So we wanted to take a deep dive and take a look at what's going on, what are some of the contributing factors, and what some of the external factors are.
We'll talk about that, but first, what's the scale of the problem? And do you think that, based on your reporting, we're looking at a wave of closures of HBCUs in the next few years?
Well, we hope not, but there are a lot of people who are predicting within the next, probably by like 2035, black colleges can be down by about 35 colleges. Right now, we have 101 black colleges that are accredited by the Department of Education. That means that they're accredited, so that means that these are historically black colleges. For those listeners here in Atlanta, for example, Morris Brown College is not listed among those 101 mm-hmm. because they've lost accreditation. So, you know, as Eric was saying, you know, there are a lot of financial constraints that are going on. There are a lot of schools right now who are, you know, who are struggling. So, you know, in 20, 30 years, there could be a drop in the number of historically black colleges. As you can, as your listeners probably know, at one point we had about 500 female women's colleges. Sure. Now we're down to about 35. Two historically black ones, Bennett College in Greensboro and Spelman College, of course, in Atlanta. So, you know, we have seen instances where specific types of colleges have closed. There's a lot of things that have to happen for that to happen. There are a lot of things that historically black colleges and states, which control public schools, are going to have to do to make sure that that does not happen.
We talked with filmmaker Stanley Nelson. His new documentary is called Tell Them We Are Rising, The Story of Black Colleges and Universities. And he told us that from where he sits, HBCUs are not struggling. They're, in fact, thriving. Let's listen.
These are, you know, strong, incredible institutions. You know, they, you know, they have, you know, huge buildings and, you know, libraries, and they are, you know, viable institutions. I think that, you know, you have no more committed and enthusiastic alumni group than alumni of HBCUs.
Be that as it may, based on your reporting, gentlemen, it looks as though HBCUs still have significant challenges, as you said, declining enrollments and academic challenges, low graduation rates. What are the sources? What are the root causes of these phenomena that you're tracing?
Well, there are several things. And I think Stanley is right. I mean, but I think that he, in that quote that you played, there are a lot of things that he did not include. One of the challenges is the fact that, you know, for example, that a lot of talented black high school students have a lot of options now. When I was going to college in 1985, I graduated from high school in 1985. When my parents' generations were graduated from high school in the 60s and 50s, they didn't have a lot of options. So now, you know, a talented kid out of a South DeKalb high school with a, you know, great SAT score can go to Georgia Tech, or he can go to Morehouse. And if Georgia Tech presents a better financial package, he's going to go to Georgia Tech. So, I mean, I think that there's a lot of competition, and, you know, we're kind of, you know, we talk about, you know, diversity in higher education, but what's happening with that diversity push in higher education is that we're pushing a lot of our great talented students away from historically black colleges. So they're ending up at, you know, majority white institutions, and that's affecting the pool. But, you know, we need better alumni support. We need better state support. There are a lot of factors that go into what makes a historically black college less healthy than their white counterparts. And I think Arrowhead, yeah.
Yeah, and to echo on what Ernie was saying about state support, we found that a number of states have significantly cut their funding for higher education in recent years, some by as much as 50%. And that has a disproportionate impact on HBCUs. And then also there were some changes in some...
Why is that the case?
I think a lot of it came out of the recession. You know, there
no,
were
no, no. Why is it the impact disproportionate on HBCUs? For example, here in Georgia, we have three public HBCUs, I think.
Yes, that's correct. And so, what you have is a situation where these are colleges that are dealing with, I mean, that are educating a larger number of low-income students and first-generation college students. And so, you know, in many cases, they're dealing, you know, with different financial challenges. And so traditionally, these are schools that have, you know, have already had those challenges. And then, and then with these state funding cuts, it just makes it a lot more difficult for them to educate and to do some of the things that they need to do to graduate students.
And even in the best of times, historically black college, public historically black colleges are not funded at the same clip as public white colleges. So, you know, even in the best of times, so in the worst of times, when we have these recessions, we have these cutbacks, the black colleges are going to suffer more because they're getting less.
Indeed. The series that you've done includes a podcast, which is terrific because it gives us tape to play on the air now. So thanks for that.
Thank you.
Let's hear from Robert Cole, who graduated from Morehouse College in 1987. He says that the fraternity environment there was crucial for him.
I grew up, you know, as an only child, and so I didn't have brothers and sisters in the household. And so when I went to Morehouse, you know, I looked at all of the fraternities because I wanted that bond, if you will. And I actually went on I got a scholarship from Omega Psi Phi Fraternity Incorporated as a high school senior.
Here's another voice from the podcast that y'all have done. This is Imani Watts, who is currently a sophomore at Spelman. And she recalls that when she first visited the campus, this is what sold her on it.
The environment was very eye-opening, I would say. You're surrounded by beautiful black women who are all achieving so much. It's very inspiring. The campus is beautiful.
So, gentlemen, those two quotes really speak to the perennial relevancy question. HBCUs, of course, historically started off with a very clear purpose, which was that black students were barred from admission at colleges and universities, mainstream colleges and universities in the South and in other places too. But now the question why is a little bit more present, especially when I consider the factor that you were just mentioning, which is that one of the things that's drawing black students away from HBCUs is predominantly white institutions wanting to increase their diversity and therefore aggressively recruiting very, very strong black students and other students of color. And that's generally regarded, not universally, but generally regarded as a good thing, and yet it has this negative outcome on HBCUs. How can those two things coexist? If diversity at mainstream colleges is good, does that not inherently, implicitly argue that HBCUs themselves are not as important today as they used to be?
Well, I mean, that brings up a very touchy subject. I attended an HBCU, and I think the question you're asking, and not you, but the question that the world asks is, you know, because white colleges now are accepting black kids and black kids are going to white colleges, and then what we have, our institutions are no longer valuable. they're no longer needed, which is a very false narrative. Historical black colleges have always going to be they've always been relevant because of how they started. They're always going to be relevant because of who they serve. Just because some of our best students, some of our best students are going to UGA or Georgia State or Emory, it doesn't mean all of them are. And these black colleges still serve a role. Eric is the numbers guy, but there's still a lot of kids at these 101 black colleges right now who are the first people in their families to go to college. I was the first person in my family to go to college in 1985. That totally changed the trajectory of my family dynamic. And this is still happening now. So when you have, you know, whatever the number is, of first-generation students who are able to go to, you know, North Carolina Central University or Morehouse or Tennessee State University, that's big. That's important. I went to the Fox Theater to watch the 30th anniversary of School Days, and that's Spike Lee's historic movie about historically black colleges. Mm-hmm. And it was 5,000 people there in their historically black college sweaters and their Greek sweaters dancing in the aisles, celebrating black colleges. And I think that's what kind of it's all about. It's not all about homecoming. It's not all about, you know, this family atmosphere, because academics and giving back is very important. But to question whether or not these schools are still relevant now is just kind of a wrong way to go into looking at them.
And when I and you played the clip from Imani, you know, it was interesting to talk to her. And, you know, I interviewed her and talking to other students. And one of the things that you hear from students constantly is that they feel that it's a nurturing environment. And I think that's one of the things that still draws a lot of African-American students to HBCUs. And then you're just looking at, you know, what's been going on politically in recent years. You know, you hear many students talking about looking for colleges that are safe spaces. And so for many students, you know, they're looking at what's going on nationally with, you know, some of the controversial speakers at some colleges, and they're looking at Trump administration policies. And so for many African-American students, they still see HBCUs as a place where they can feel like they can get a good education, learn about their culture, and, you know, engross, you know, in so many ways.
Indeed. And you mentioned President Trump. In the last 30 seconds that we have here, everybody remembers that in the first days of his administration, President Trump gathered presidents of HBCUs from across the country in the Oval Office and signed some kind of executive order indicating an intent to provide greater federal support for those schools. Whatever happened with that?
When you find out what happened to that executive order, let us know.
That's what I thought you were going to say.
Yeah, we have no idea. We have no idea. I mean, but, you know, I think HBCUs just have to keep plugging along. And one thing, and as we close, historically, black colleges have always been open. So, you know, there's this talk about, you know, are they still needed? But, you know, they're open. White kids can come. Hispanic right. kids can come. We welcome all.
That was my conversation with AJC reporters Eric Sturgis and Ernie Suggs about their series, HBCUs, A Threatened Heritage. It's On Second Thought. I'm Adam Ragusa. Brace yourselves, Atlanta. Fans of anime, gaming, comics, and animation are pouring in for this year's MomoCon. It's one of the fastest-growing all-ages conventions in the country, with more than 90,000 visitors expected this year. The convention features actors, artists, collectors, and people who like to dress up. Cosplayers, they call them. MomoCon begins today. We'll meet some of the artists making appearances at the convention. Let's start with two Atlanta-based authors working to diversify the comic book world. Marcus Williams and Greg Burnham are the creative force behind a comic that pays tribute to the distinguished Tuskegee Airmen. The comic weaves African-American history into an epic mission to save the planet. My colleague Celeste Headley spoke with this creative duo about their comic, Tuskegee Airs, Flames of Destiny. She began by asking why they set this book in the future.
So how did you settle on the date? And we don't actually, I mean, I've only read the first one. Yeah. So we don't know, except that they do mention that there is the final unification treaty in 2081. So we know it's after. How did you pick the date?
So we had to balance. So we have a backstory upon a backstory upon a backstory. So that date was created to kind of stay with the timeline.
So our listeners know, at this point in whatever year it is, all flying is done by drones. Everyone does it remotely.
Correct.
But for some reason, there's this secret group of pilots who are actually flying real planes.
Right.
And then when they get their real planes, they're like Transformers.
Yes.
they're not just a plane, they're also a robot.
Yes. Correct.
So why not, if you're these are going to be the heirs of Tuskegee, and they're located in Tuskegee, their secret base.
Correct.
Mm-hmm. Why not just tell the story of the Tuskegee Airmen?
Well, there was a good conversation we had, me and Greg, and it was pretty quick because we wanted to keep all lines uncrossed in regards to disrespecting any families of the actual pilots. We didn't want to use any real names. We didn't want to come off of as trying to, you know, take advantage of their wonderful achievements and just say, oh, hey, this is so-and-so's kid, you know, a couple years removed.
I see.
So we just said how the best way we can do that is to create our own cast and remove it, you know, a number of years where we can actually set it.
Lots of years.
Exactly. And have those kids look up to the pilots in admiration. So that way, young kids picking up the book who have no idea about the Tuskegee Airmen can sit in that same seat and also look back and say, who? But the kids are, you know, very versed and very well aware of the history of the Tuskegee Airmen in the book. And they are, you know, that vehicle for new readers to that concept, and they're like, oh, okay, cool. I never knew who the Tuskegee Airmen are. So that way we have that nice little vehicle for them, that they're seeing the history.
So generally when we read a comic book that people say is helping diversify the comic universe, right, the industry, you're going to have a mix of people, right? Let's say that there's like 7 main characters, 4 of them will be white, 1 or 2 of them will be African-American. You'll have an Asian kid, maybe, you know, Filipino, a Latino, sassy girl. You know what I'm saying?
Right, yeah.
That's what we're used to seeing is this mix. Mm-hmm. You, at least in the first comic book so far, they're all African-American. How conscious was that choice?
It was semi, like, conscious. Like, we wanted, we actually have this whole world. They're going to be going all over the world. So you're going to come in contact with indigenous people from everywhere. So it is multicultural. But I don't know if we talked about just, like, these are our heroes. These are our main characters, and everything kind of stems from that. So we're telling the story. Like, the beginning is them. You'll see them, and then as we go, it'll branch out.
Yeah, I mean, you end the first comic with way more questions.
Yeah, that's
that's on purpose.
And that's intentional. Like, I've had people, like, yelling at me, like, what happened when Paul? I'm like,
it's the first issue, man.
We're doing it on purpose. Like, we've studied. Like you said, we've read a lot of comics.
Right.
We watch a lot of anime and TV. So I think we understand how to keep people, you know, with their knives and forks.
Ready to eat.
Right. Yeah.
Well, mission accomplished there. Yeah. I mean, the last question for you is it a benefit or a limitation when you're working with crowdfunding, as opposed to selling your project to a publisher and getting it published the, I guess, traditional classic way?
That was something that I learned firsthand because I did start on a comic that got published nationally. It was called Hero Cats of Stellar City. And the opportunities that opened up because of that book, I was able to go to, like, comic expo retailer summits and talk to publishers firsthand, talk to, you know, other artists, talk to everyone that's been in the industry. And there is a trade-off. There's pros and cons of both. If you have no money and you know, want to get your idea out, a publisher is a great opportunity because they will absorb the cost of printing. They will absorb the cost of going to shows. If you can't afford to go to San Diego Comic-Con, the publisher will.
And they can wait till it starts to make money.
Absolutely.
They have the cushion.
Absolutely. However, the cons of that is if you're trying to make a living in that scenario, the publisher has to pay themselves back. So you may not see money until they see, you know, a surplus of money from issue 1 and you're on issue 5. So it's a love, passion, you know, thing. But self-publishing, Kickstarter, and those things do have these wonderful cons where people pay you for the concept if you don't have the book already. And that's really, really unique. I go to the schools and I talk to kids and I'm like, that's very rare in the freelance world. You don't meet any clients that say, hey man, you have any good ideas that I can give you money to create for yourself? It doesn't work like that anywhere else. So crowdsourcing and these sites are really, really special in that way, where you can say, I have a concept. I don't have any money to do the printing and the publishing and distribution, but if you guys give me that, I can. So that's where it's a really, really special play. And a lot of even industry level artists are going to Kickstarters and all these crowdsourcing funds, even though they have money. They still would rather say, I'll let my fans decide if they want this or not. And then they can prepay for it and pre-order it. And I'll, you know, I'll send it out from there.
And that's one of the great things about it is the fan contact, right? Right. So we've been told, we've been working on, you know, all these ideas for a long time, but we were told, you know, you got to diversify. So when you can actually show there are fans that are willing to put money in, it, as a creator, I think it's great because it lets you know that some of the things, you know, the standard, you know, the gatekeepers, you know, the stuff that they hold out, no, there's really people that want it. Mm-hmm. And so we see that when we go to conventions, we see that on public, you know, on social media. So I think that is just as important because now since we had so much success on Kickstarter, we get a lot of people that ask us what to do. And I tell them all the time, man, like, put your ideas out and see if people.
It's still hard. Well, crowdfunding is not easy.
Right, yeah. Right. But you kind of get an idea. Like, if I put it, if we post something on social media in a bunch of different places and only like 3 or 4 people like it, it doesn't mean it's bad. It just means that there you got work to do before you start trying to raise money.
That's Marcus Williams and Greg Burnham, creators of the comic book series Tuskegee Airs: Flames of Destiny. You can meet them at Atlanta's MomoCon, which starts today and lasts all weekend in Atlanta. They spoke with my colleague Celeste Headley. Let's go from still images to images that move. Alisa Lewis is an animator on FX's Archer and the director of Reimagine ATL. She spoke with my colleague Virginia Prescott.
Alisa, I think it's safe to say that all kids love watching cartoons, but you made your career in it. Do you remember your first cartoon watching it?
The first cartoons I watched were Popeye and Looney Tunes. A lot of the older cartoons, I wasn't allowed to watch live television. So my parents would get these VHSs, and they would watch it first, and then I could watch it. But ultimately, they would be very, very old.
So they'd go through the parental censor first to make sure it was okay to watch. What were they afraid of? Violence or?
Just anything that they weren't prepared for. So anything that we watched, they wanted to be able to talk to us about and make sure that it wasn't anything that went against how they wanted to raise us.
Yeah. When did you start actually working in animation?
The first time I started working in animation was right here at Georgia Public Broadcasting. Back in 2008, I got my start on the World War II project, and I got to do a lot of interviews and work on website stuff and also do a lot of art.
You won an Emmy for animating Archer. You were there for 5 seasons. Here's just a clip from the show.
Conway could be dangerous.
Yeah. You know what's dangerous? Your obsession with me.
Just
seriously, Lana, call Kenny Loggins because you're in the danger zone from Top Gun.
Just be careful.
No.
A clip there from Archer. That must have been a really fun show to work on.
It was. It's great working in comedy. Anything that makes you laugh is worth going to each morning.
So what I'm curious about the process, however, when did they bring the animators in on a show like Archer? Do they work on the script? Do you work on it together? How does that happen?
So it's a big collaborative process. You have the scripts being written. They get approved by the network, and then it goes to concept development. Eventually, the storyboarders get it, and then the people who make the characters. So the character designers, the people who make the assets, and the people who draw our wonderful backgrounds. When I get it is after the animatic and the assets are made. So after the character designer is done, the background painter is done, and all the props I need, like guns and vases and anything that's going to move. As an animator, you get to put everything together on screen and make sure that it's lined up correctly according to the storyboard. And then it's really up to you to decide how the acting is going to go. You get some cues, but your creativity really determines how much you're going to push the scene.
Oh, so facial expressions. And obviously, you have to lip sync, right?
Yes.
You must be an expert on lip syncing.
I am. I actually read lips. I've been reading Lips since I was in middle school, a little sneaky way for me to watch television without my parents hearing the volume. And now I can lip sync animation quite quickly, and I was the main lip syncer for the show.
Oh, that's so funny. What's your favorite part of the process of being an animator on a show like that?
Lip syncing definitely is my favorite part. Whenever you get to tune in on a dialogue and really pay attention to the nuances of what people are saying, it gives you a greater understanding of comedic timing and how our culture is informing humor.
You work right now for Reimagine ATL, but your own company is called My Animation Life, and this is about pairing talented people with jobs, is that right?
Yes, it's all about employment services and making sure that artists are able to sustain their careers through resources like education and networking and mentorships. Mentorships are actually our fastest growing resource. It's where we pair artists with professionals in the industry to hold their hands through their career.
So is this a challenge in the industry for people who are working on productions to find talented artists?
It is. There are so many jobs here, especially in Georgia, as we have this entertainment boom. But the disconnect is that a lot of the people with the jobs don't know qualified artists, and a lot of qualified artists don't know how to find jobs.
Well, you have lived in Atlanta for decades now, but you're originally from Brooklyn, right?
I am.
Right.
I love Brooklyn. I'm from the intersection of Troy and Church. It's a little West Indian quarter.
So you're from a West Indian family?
Yes, both my parents are Guyanese, and the rest of my family is from all over the Caribbean.
So I'm wondering how that influenced your art and your expression, especially if your parents were kind of strict, it sounds like, about what you could take in.
I tend to be more conservative in my art because of my Caribbean background, and a lot of the humor and themes, they reflect the kind of lifestyles and culture that Caribbean people have. Definitely in my more voiceover art, I try to put a more Caribbean accent in. And it's starting to slip out right now, the more that we talk about it. But I've done stop motion films with Amanda Christine Smith, and she is fantastic with her stop motions, and she's allowed me to use a Caribbean dialect. You have two different sides of Caribbean culture, and unlike a lot of what I see in America, where you have this rainbow of personalities, I find that there is this duality between the ultra-conservative and the ultra-liberal. And days like the Caribbean Festival, you really get to express your more liberal side. Mm. It's about togetherness, and everyone's welcome. So it's even if you're very conservative, this is your non-judgmental day, where you go in and just celebrate with everyone.
Well, I'd love to get to this duality a little bit, because I think of anime and gaming and comic culture. For years, that's been really dominated by white men, hasn't it? I mean, is that changing?
Absolutely, especially with this prevalence of inclusion and people being focused on making sure that harassment is kept to a minimum, and with people in the media really stressing that everyone should be able to enjoy everything together. I could speak to how the climate of minorities has changed throughout this country, and that's definitely influencing our leisure time. But for the most part, today, anime is more inclusive because everyone is getting together and making sure that there's a space for each person.
So you see that at MomoCon, for example.
MomoCon is fantastic. I go every year, and they have a large focus on diversity.
Now, we have a clip from an interview that we did with Marcus Williams. He's co-creator of the new comic, Tuskegee Airs, Flames of Destiny, and that's Airs, H-E-I-R-S. He's going to be a panelist at this year's MomoCon. Let's hear a little bit.
Young kids picking up the book who have no idea about the Tuskegee Airmen can sit in that same seat and also look back and say, who? But the kids are, you know, very versed and very well aware of the history of the Tuskegee Airmen in the book.
So do you know Marcus?
I do. I first met him 3 years ago, and I fell in love with his storytelling. It is an amazing series, and it's really reshaping how comics are done here in Georgia. He's introducing the idea of the Black Fantastic on a scale that is more attainable to independent artists. He's at every comic convention, he's at every artistic gathering, and he's out there telling people that if you have a story, there are several resources for you to get it told And he's offering support to young artists.
That was Elisa Lewis speaking with On Second Thoughts' Virginia Prescott. She's an animator on FX's Archer and the director of Reimagine ATL. She'll be at MomoCon this week as well. MomoCon begins today and ends Sunday at the Omni Hotel in downtown Atlanta. Details are on our site, gpbnews.org. It's On Second Thought. I'm Adam Ragusea. Over the last few weeks, you've heard Virginia Prescott a few times on our show. She is going to be On Second Thought's new host. She debuts in that role on Tuesday. As we enter this new chapter of this show's history, we'd like to hear from you. What do you want Virginia to work on? What do you think is the most underreported story in Georgia? What stories are happening in your community that you want Virginia and her team to cover? Seriously, we want to know. Call us at 404-500-9457. You can find us on Twitter and Facebook, and then be sure to join us tomorrow at 9 a.m. for more. Earlier this week, we previewed the Bitter Southerner Magazine's summer reading picks. The Hidden Light of Northern Fires is a book that's on that list. It's by Decatur-based author Darren Wong, who offers a fresh take on the American Civil War. He spoke last year with my colleague, Celeste Headley.
This town that you write about is Town Line, New York.
Yeah.
And the interesting tidbit about it is that it was the only town. It's just outside Buffalo, right?
Yes.
It's the only town north of the Mason-Dixon line that seceded.
Yes. Yes.
And interestingly enough, did not rejoin the Union until like the
1940s? 1946, January 1946, to be precise.
So you pitched this for years to authors to, to have them write it as a book.
Yeah, I mean, because somebody ought to, right?
So give me an example of how you pitched them.
Well, if you're out drinking with authors or something like
which
that,
I'm sure you know, you've done
as often. I would often do because with the festival, and you know, these stories would come up, you know, of and particularly down here in the South, a bizarre Southern, granddad or great great granddad buried the silver in the backyard kind of
right.
stories, and I would say, you want a real Southern story? How about this? You know, my town, 15 miles from the Canadian border, seceded from the Union, and my house was on the Underground Railroad. You should write that. And they go, and then I would do.
And you could never convince anyone to write that story.
No, you can't convince anybody to write a story. Everybody has a, it's not hard to come up with a good story to write. It's the work of spending a couple of years of your life on it. That's the hard part.
So you, and before that, you had been a writer, but you'd written short stories and shorter pieces. Mm-hmm. You had never written a full-length book.
Yeah. Well, I hadn't even really taken on fiction at all. I'd written pieces for, journalist pieces, yeah, reviews and stuff like that, but I'd never really taken on a novel.
So you described it to the AJC as that you had to teach yourself how to write in order to do this book.
Yeah, well, how to write a good sentence. You know, it's not easy to put on to get the rhythm and the complexity of a good sentence and have different things going on. And if you pay attention to those things, it's not, hopefully as a reader you never notice it, but as a writer you want to get it right.
So how do you teach yourself to write a novel? How does one do that? I mean, you've been reading, assuming, your whole life. So what else do you need to do?
Well, one perfect example is the main character, Mary Willis, who's running this Underground Railroad station, right?
Yeah.
And her true history is she had 17 siblings. So, and I have a list of all those people when they were born and everything like that. So as I start to write, I feel like all of those siblings have to be in there, right? And I have a draft where she has 17 siblings and they get named at some point. It's terrible.
Yeah, you can't
terrible,
keep track of
right?
all of them.
You know,
yeah.
They serve no purpose. They just exist there. And, in particular around writing historical fiction, it's about as much about what goes as what stays. So learning that, make sure the when the chapter ends that you want to you want to turn the page and go to the next
like
the
a
next
cliffhanger
chapter.
Right,
yeah, that there's something driving it forward, that the idea that nothing should be in a sentence or in a paragraph or a page that doesn't need to be there, all those kind of ideas.
So tell me a little bit about Mary, your main character, and what was true and what isn't. I think lively is a fair word. She's quite young, just out of college, just a fierce, 19th century feminist. So how much of that did you create?
Well, so Mary Willis, the true story of Mary Willis is she went away to college at Alfred University in 1857. She's about 18 years old at the time. Well, you know, women did not go to college in 1858. And she went to Alfred University, which was only the second school in the country to take women.
Yeah.
And it was Alfred is about 30 miles from Seneca Falls, New York, which is the epicenter of feminism. So these things come together. And Rochester, New York, is where Frederick Douglass is writing. So all of these radical ideas are floating in the ethos in Western New York at the time. So it's reasonable to assume this woman is, I mean, she's imbued with this kind of feminism. And so that's, I'm taking that as true, right? She goes to college. She comes home, 1858, and starts running an underground railroad station
from the house
barn
that you ended up living
yeah,
in.
Yeah. Well, it was a barn at the time.
Oh yeah.
Right? And it was converted into a house
so
later.
So that part's true.
Yeah, all of that's true.
I have to imagine this happens with everyone who writes historical fiction where the reader is sitting there going, "Wait, which part of this is true and which isn't?" So, were there actually Confederate secret agents having raids across the border?
Can you believe that? I mean, nobody talks about this, but there was the Confederate Secret Service was run by a guy named Jacob Thompson, who there's a large monument to Jacob Thompson in downtown Oxford, Mississippi. He is and he became the basis for the Compson family in all of Faulkner's books. One of Faulkner's books. He was implicated in 1865 in the John Booth, John Wilkes Booth conspiracy, and had to flee the country. He lived over in England on $200,000 of mysteriously appeared hard cash for several years there before moving back to Oxford after supposedly clearing his name. But whether it was never really cleared, but there's this whole outlandish plot with Johnson's Island. Historically, this is true that he hired a guy named John Yates Beale, who was from right around Harper's Ferry, West Virginia. It was Virginia at the time; it hadn't split off. To go to Johnson's Island, which is where there's an island full of Confederate soldiers that were prisoners, to take them to Buffalo, to break them free, arm them, take them to Buffalo, and set them loose to open up a northern front. This is all documented plot. It fell apart, obviously.
Yeah, but, clearly.
Yeah. but these kind of, you know, we never think about the Canadians' influence in the Civil War, but it's quite an active border at the time.
So why is there such fodder for fiction coming out of the Civil War? Why do we seem to never tire of those stories?
Well, I think, aren't we fighting the Civil War essentially in some ways right now? I mean, we're not in the street, generally not in the streets with guns, but...
Well, they were in Charlottesville.
Yeah, they were in Charlottesville. Those battles still rage one way or the other. It's, you know, one of the, in my opinion, one of the tragedies of the Civil War, one of the wounds that has never been healed was, you know, with the assassination of Abraham Lincoln, you know, there was never a proper movement to reconcile. You know, Johnson, you know, his
he was all about appeasement, yeah.
Yeah, it was never to get it right after that. And we've never healed from it.
So you had to create, well, let's go back to the town. I want to make sure I say it right. It's Town Line, New York.
Yes.
And this was settled by Germans. This is a real town.
Yes.
And let's talk about how this town came to secede, which was part of the whole beginnings of this novel, right?
Yes. So so first off, Town Line, New York is a hamlet. It's a crossroads. It has no legal standing. It is the line between Alden, New York, and Lancaster, New York.
It's literally a town line.
Yeah, it is. There's no mayor. There's no city council. There's no legal standing. There's no. They have a volunteer fire department, and up until a few years, the volunteer fire department, their shoulder patch said "Last of the Rebels," 1865 to 1946. Which is incorrect because, of course, they actually seceded in 1861. But you know, there's a mythos going on here anyway, right? So, there's no contemporary documentation for the secession, but it's pretty clearly established that it happened. It was a vote of 100 to 23, It's not quite clear what happened now.
Or why.
Yeah. So,
I mean, you imagine for your novel a lot of those motivations and what was happening in the town at the time. But historically, do we have an answer to that?
Well, so Town Line, which is a pretty right-wing place today and has been for a long time.
I would imagine if they had those patches on there, yeah.
Imagine an alignment with the Confederacy, and there's a claim that they sent seven of their local boys south to fight in the war of Northern or in the Army of Northern Virginia. There's no documentation for that. I've never seen a name of anybody that did it. It's a very hypothetical thing. And that kind of thing, that story kind of floated in 1946 when the reunification happened. But the real historical basis is, I've talked to descendants of people who were there, and largely the idea that I put out in the book is I think holds water.
The book also sort of forces us to contend with this idea of being an outsider. I mean, she's in the North, but she herself is very progressive. She went to a co-ed college, which at that time is very racy. And she's surrounded by this very conservative, as you describe even today, right-wing town. Is that something that you had experience with, or was that a sort of situation of being just kind of Cassandra screaming behind the walls of Troy, right? Was that a situation you had to fully imagine?
No, I'm half Asian, I'm half Chinese, and I grew up. I mean, there's not a minority, or there certainly wasn't besides me
in
Town Line when I was growing up, that kind of outsider status just felt absolutely natural to me. It wasn't hard to guess.
That's author Darren Wong speaking with my colleague Celeste Headley. His latest novel is The Hidden Light of Northern Fires. It made the Bitter Southerner magazine's summer reading list this year. What are you reading right now? What should other people put on their summer reading list? You can call us at 404-500-9457, and you can find us on Twitter and Facebook as well. Let's end today's show with some jazz from some of the youngest and most talented musicians in Georgia. You can hear a group of talented middle school performers at this weekend's Atlanta Jazz Festival. They are Rialto Jazz for Kids. On Second Thought, intern Emmanuel Johnson visited the group during a recent rehearsal.
Set and a 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3.
I'm Dr. Gordon Vernick, and I'm the director of jazz studies here at Georgia State University, and their director of the Rialto Jazz for Kids program and the Rialto Youth Jazz Orchestra, which is the high school version of the Rialto Jazz for Kids, which is for middle schoolers. All the kids who participate in this program are from five of our partner schools. We partner with Taylor Road Middle School, Inman Middle School, Ridgeview, Sequoia, and Summeror.
So when Hisu or Jisoo, depending on whether she's jazzy today or not, solos, right, we should be thinking, all right, number one, the flute's a
My name is Hisu Jong, and I play flute. I go to Taylor Road Middle School. You know, I started flute in like sixth grade, and I joined the school jazz band in this year in eighth grade. And yeah, Dr. Vernie came to our school to help us, and I got into it. It wasn't really that hard because I just liked it that like I'm like the only flute, so it's like really fun with like play with other people. that not in our school. And it's like really good to listen to other people solo and like how do they do.
I'm Leslie Gordon. I'm the director of the Rialto Center at Georgia State University. Rialto Jazz for Kids is an initiative of the Rialto Center at Georgia State. When people come to hear the Jazz for Kids All-Stars, they never know what to expect. They think they're going to see a group of scraggly kids coming up on a stage and playing jazz type music. What they see is a pretty disciplined core of young people who will blow them away with how good they are at what they do. I've been there every year, and to hear the comments, I just love wandering around and listening to what people have to say. They really don't know that they're just in middle school. I mean, when you say these are 6th, 7th, and 8th graders, they're astounded.
I'm Riley Beener. I'm 14 and I go to Ridgeview Charter School, middle school. My instrument that I play is the alto saxophone. I got involved with Rialto by my band teachers. They recommended me. Actually, we have a jazz combo that meets in the morning, and Dr. Vernick and Mace, they go there every month and they teach us how to improv and solo. And my band teachers recommended me to come to Rialto along with 5 other members from our jazz combo, and I think it's been good. I think we get a lot done in class, and they really help us work out all the problems and kinks we have in our song. Only thing I could say is I wish that we had like another day at some point to practice, because I feel like once a week, even if it's for 2 hours, just isn't a lot of time.
The story was produced by On Second Thought intern Emmanuel Johnson. You can see Rialto Jazz for Kids perform live at this weekend's Atlanta Jazz Festival. And that's our show for today. We talked earlier this hour about the financial health of historically black colleges and universities. Have you attended one of these schools? Are you attending one right now? Do you work at one? Do you think that HBCUs are institutions that need to be preserved? Why did you go to an HBCU? Tell us about your choices. Give us a call, 404-500-9457. Or you can post on Twitter or Facebook. We're at OST Talk. Show is produced by Fenley Foxen, LaRaven Taylor, Leighton Rowell, and Summer Evans. Sean Powers is the senior producer. Don Smith edits the show, and our engineer is Tyler Morris. For today, that's On Second Thought from GPB News. I'm Adam Ragusea. Have a good one.